This is Marketplace Money for the week of January 22nd, 2010. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, supporting financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide since 1937. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. This was one bad week for some of the nation's top banks. Citigroup reported it lost more than $7 billion in the final 3 months of last year. Bank of America lost more than $5 billion. And then on Thursday, President Obama said there should be no such thing as banks that are too big to fail. And he proposed far-reaching regulations to rein them in. He also called once again for a new consumer agency, sort of a consumer product safety commission for things like mortgages and credit cards. Just a week earlier, the idea seemed in peril. So we've asked Elizabeth Warren to join us again. She's a professor of law at Harvard and also came up with the idea for this agency a few years ago. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Now, we last got a progress report from you in early October, and at the time, you still had quite a bit of faith that we would get this consumer agency. So I will ask you now again, are you still keeping that faith?
It's been a roller coaster ride, but I've still got the faith.
Why?
Well, you know, there was an announcement last week that indicated that the agency was dead.
And in fact, that was from Senator Dodd, who chairs the Senate Banking Committee. So
said the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
And the President of the United States said not so fast. And he's pushing back and pushing back hard.
What do you think it would mean for consumers if the CFPA is scrapped?
Then it means financial reform wasn't serious. When the administration first announced, here's our financial reform package, the lobbyists for the big banks said, we will kill the consumer agency. And they also basically went through the rest of the bill and, you know, took out their little red pens and decided which parts were acceptable to them and which parts weren't. So the consumer agency really is. It's the litmus test for determining, are we going to have a bank pre-approved version of financial reform, which frankly means business as usual, or are we going to get serious and make some changes to rein in the out-of-control banks that have brought us this crisis?
You know, the economy imploded in 2008, and we are now in January of 2010. Do you think consumers are any safer now when it comes to financial products like mortgages than they were before the collapse?
No, not at all. This is, in fact, an even more dangerous world, if that's possible. There are no new effective rules effectively enforced in place. We're still operating largely under the same set of rules that brought us this crisis. I don't want to be a total naysayer, sure. There have been some little places around the edges. But the fundamental problem is that consumers are not offered contracts that they can read and easily understand. The idea that we can, you know, change a comma here or a margin over there and make any real difference is just, it's just fundamentally wrong.
What about the argument that it's up to all of us to, you know, buyer beware, and that
sure,
it's our responsibility to be
reading
the paperwork?
You bet. Let's just let the banks hire an army of lawyers to lawyer up these contracts and let them hire an army of MBAs to figure out how many new tricks you can devise that no one can explain. You know, try explaining double cycle billing and
right,
you know, reverse half Nelson off the high dive.
I never understood that one.
That's right. And just throw them out there and say, hey, if you open a checking account here, you agreed to be bound. If you really believe in free markets, if you really are a market person and you think people ought to be personally responsible for what they commit to, then what you ought to stand behind is that they can read and see the provisions that they are committing to.
Elizabeth Warren is a professor of law at Harvard University, and she also chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel on Banking Bailouts. And we've been talking to her about the prospects for a consumer financial protection agency. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Congress may not be getting very far on financial reform, but here's one thing they did accomplish in record time. Legislation passed this week that allows you to deduct contributions for Haitian relief efforts from last year's taxes. Any donations made to qualifying charities by the end of February can be claimed on 2009 tax returns.
Marketplace Money is supported by LendingTree.com, offering the new loan coach, giving personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process. Just one of the many tools at the all-new LendingTree.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Here's another wrinkle for consumers. New home buyers will have to pay more for mortgages insured by the Federal Housing Administration. The FHA says it had to toughen the rules because too many of its loans were going bad. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the details.
The Federal Housing Administration doesn't make loans, it insures them. And now home buyers will have to pay more for that insurance. How much more? The FHA insurance premium you pay when you close your mortgage will jump by half a percentage point. That would add $1,000 to the cost of a $200,000 loan. Paul Leonard is the California director of the Center for Responsible Lending.
These new requirements will have a substantial impact on a large number of borrowers. They'll pay more in premiums up front and potentially over time.
Over time, because the FHA plans to ask Congress if it can raise the limit on annual premiums for FHA-backed loans. The FHA will also require consumers with credit scores lower than 580 to make down payments of at least 10%. But that change shouldn't affect many borrowers. It's already almost impossible to get a loan with a credit score that low. David Barenbaum is with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He says the new rules don't put home ownership out of reach.
Consumers will have to save. They will have to work toward the goals of home ownership. But for many affordable housing units in America, it's very, very doable.
The FHA wants to keep risky borrowers from buying homes. Housing analyst Karen Petru of Federal Financial Analytics says the FHA had to tighten up the rules.
To the degree that it insured loans that were unsafe for the borrower, risky home ownership was perpetuated. The borrower was at risk of foreclosure, and FHA ultimately paid for that.
The FHA had to pay off lenders when borrowers defaulted on FHA-insured loans. Its reserves plummeted. The new fees will go toward fattening them back up again, so the FHA doesn't have to turn to taxpayers for money. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace Money.
What if you didn't have to deal with the FHA at all? Or mortgage brokers? Or hiring a plumber to fix the faucet? Well, that would make you a renter. Home ownership used to be a given for, you know, grown-ups. But the down economy has spawned a new breed of financially mature specimens. They're called perma-renters. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
Milan Mishanovich and his wife, Rebecca Eggeman, live in a three-bedroom house in Santa Barbara. They can see the ocean from their backyard.
So here we have a couple of fruit trees, and then on the other side you can see the Channel Islands.
Milan and Rebecca both have graduate degrees, high-paying jobs, excellent credit, a new baby, and absolutely no plans to buy a house.
I kind of got the impression that maybe people felt a little sorry for us because we were renting. I'd say we were moving, and the response would be, oh, did you buy a house? You know, and I'd be like, well, no, we're still renting.
Still renting. In a culture obsessed with home ownership, still renting makes Milan and Rebecca feel like social outcasts.
It has to make financial sense. I mean, look, we're not in some weird sect.
If they sound a little defensive, they have reason to be, says Nicholas Ritsinas. He heads up the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University.
Rent could be, not to be too glib, but really was a four-letter word. That you must be dumb if you're still renting. You must be too poor. It was like, well, if you did everything right and you were smart and you worked hard, you should be an owner.
Milan and Rebecca have done all the math and say it doesn't make sense for them to buy right now. And when I say they've done all the math, I mean they've done all the math.
The median income for Santa Barbara is around $77,000 a year.
You shouldn't buy a house more than three times your annual income with a 20% down payment.
Even though the numbers are on their side, even though they avoided the housing bust that stung many of their friends, and even though they did so much homework, they saw the crash coming and got their money out of the market before it tanked, Milan and Rebecca still sought out an online support group of diehard renters.
One day I remember I did a search, housing bubble, and I realized I'm not crazy. I'm not alone. There are other people who see it.
It's like this underground, people in the same position that we were that just were questioning all the economists, people on Wall Street, the media, the spin.
People not swayed by government incentives and tax breaks that favor owning. Personal finance expert Jordan Goodman says there are real financial advantages to renting.
You're not subject to property tax increases. You also are more mobile. Since you're not stuck in a home that you can't sell, in many cases, rents are lower than what you'd have to pay for certain the combination of mortgage costs and maintenance.
Ann Goodman says couples who rent can invest that extra money instead of sinking it into a house that may go down in value. Still, that didn't deter new homeowner Matthew Bickle.
I look at buying versus renting, probably like 80% non-financial.
Bickle works in finance. He and his wife Kim just bought a house in Los Angeles. Like Milan and Rebecca, Matthew and Kim are in their mid-30s, have high-paying jobs and a young child. But Matthew says even though this is the biggest purchase they've ever made, and he thinks housing prices still have a ways to fall, it wasn't about the money.
It's the whole home aspect versus house or versus I want to have an appreciating asset. It's the place to hang your hat, you know, all those kind of silly old sayings. And you call it yours. There's a peace of mind that comes with that.
Bridget, do you want to go climb a tree? Yeah. I've already thought about how I'm going to decorate it and change it so that it'll be, a nice place for her and for us as a family. And it was all about that. And for me, not at all about a financial investment.
That version of the American dream is changing as loans become harder to get and foreclosures continue to mount.
Last night, we saw the sunset over here. It was beautiful.
Milan and Rebecca stroll through an oceanside park just down the street from their house. They come here with their son almost every day.
It just makes so much more sense to rent and to, enjoy the lifestyle and to, be steps away from the beach and have money for retirement, money for our children's college fund, and to call the landlord if the sprinklers break down.
Milan and Rebecca say their rental house is home, but they'd still like to own someday. In Santa Barbara, California, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
Coming up, when you're shopping in China, there's safety and bargains in numbers.
The list price is $400. The initial round of combat brings it down to $310, at which point the lead buyer asks her comrades, do we want more off?
Yes, indeed they do. It's purchasing power to the people. Up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We all know the concept of volume discount. Costco's, Sam's Club, their ilk. Buy 50 pounds of chicken and hope you have a lot of friends to go in on the deal, right? Well, here's a twist on that idea. What if you and your friends all showed up at a store and negotiated a discount on the spot? It's a big consumer trend in China. And who knows, a version of it may find its way here. Marketplace's Scott Tong has our story from Shanghai.
If you shop on the streets of China, be prepared for one question afterward. What'd you pay? Culturally, it's not nosy as it would be in America. Chinese friends and coworkers just come out with it. How much was your haircut? Your apartment? Or in my case, your adopted Chinese daughter. It all tells you a couple things about consumer culture here. Number one, he who gets the best price is the superior human being. And number two,
in Chinese culture, you always bargain.
Sam Fleming is the founder of Shanghai consultancy CIC. It tracks online chatter about brands and consumer preferences in China.
A lot of the clothing stores, you can bargain the price. And even at the big department stores, those sort of Best Buy type of retailers, you can usually get the price down a little bit.
To get the price down a lot, shoppers go in groups. It's called Tuanguo, group shopping. Here's how it works. First, you gather a couple hundred shoppers. In this case, new apartment owners all hungry for a good deal on fixtures. They're in the back hall of a Shanghai appliance store. Everyone here met online on a social networking website for apartment owners.
And the community is already there, so all it takes is for someone to virtually raise their hand and say, hey, let's organize.
The lead organizer of the buyers is Yu Liping. She's wielding a microphone, haggling with the enemy, seller Lan Yue. Up for sale, ceiling material, a package of ceiling tiles, recessed lighting, molding, brackets, etc. The list price is $400. The initial round of combat brings it down to $310, at which point the lead buyer asks her comrades, do we want more off? Yes, the seller then offers a free upgrade, better molding and better brackets.
You won't find a better price. I can go out on the street and get 200 orders for this price.
Now she's filibustering. She talks, she appeals, she asks, do we have a deal yet? Okay, or as they say here, okay la? Not okay la. Lead buyer says no deal. Get out. Sha chu. Seller stays and offers to come down another $3. The laughter is derisive and the group smells blood. And you can twango all kinds of things in China. Diamonds, vacations, nose jobs, as in cosmetic surgery. There's even, well, we'll let grad student Xian Li tell you.
There are like a regular group who purchase chicken feet.
Chicken feet for those late night student munchies.
Every month, someone says, I miss the chicken food and I finished all mine, so can we do another one? And then there will be someone come out to organize it.
They organize online. They do the research online, and then they go straight to the wholesale seller. In other words, they bypass the physical store. Again, internet consultant Sam Fleming.
What good is the store, right? I mean, you can do all the research. You can talk to 10,000 other people who already have the product and give you their personal recommendation. It's fundamentally changing the rules of commerce.
Fleming thinks group shopping could eventually be the next Chinese export to America. He says the Chinese are doing it first because their internet culture of web as community is more developed. Back at the bargaining, the ceiling tile seller has now gone from $400 to $285, plus several upgrades. Finally, she comes down another $15 and throws in the hyperbole for free. It all comes out to about 30% off. Quick survey of consumer sentiment. We have a deal. Afterward, the seller tells us group shopping in China is thriving in this penny-pinching recession. And the buyer notes that Twango can save apartment owners $300 on a small home project. Enough, she says, to buy brand-name toilet bowls all around. What better laurels to rest on? In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace Money.
And staff researcher Cecilia Chen contributed to our report.
You know, when it comes to investing, a lot of people just cannot get past the jargon. You've got IPOs, you've got 10-year T-notes, you've got dollar cost averaging. Might as well be, I don't know, Swahili to the uninitiated. Here to demystify some of the investing terms that matter to you and to answer some of your questions about stocks and bonds and the like is MSN Money columnist and blogger Jim Jubak. Hi, Jim.
Good to be here, Tess. How are you?
Very well. And we should tell everyone that you can be found at your blog, thejubakpicks.com. While we have you here, I wondered if you could help take us through a couple of very common questions that we get on the show, some investing basics. And the first one is, we talk a lot about the importance of diversification. What exactly does that buzzword mean, and how do you know if you're truly diversified?
A lot of people who thought they were diversified in 2007, 2008 found out to their dismay that they weren't.
Right.
What a lot of people think is, well, if I own General Motors and Ford, I don't have all of my eggs in one motor company. Well, you've got it all in the industry. And if the industry goes south, you weren't diversified.
Yeah.
What you need to find is things that don't move together. They move in opposite directions. So if you're in stocks, you might want to add some gold. If you're in stocks, you might want to add some bonds. But you're trying to find things that don't move together to lower your risk.
And I was wondering if you could help out with one other question we get, and one that I personally am flummoxed by, which is the fees that we're paying in our mutual funds and our 401ks. We are always saying here, you know, look for the low fee investment. How can you tell what fee you're paying? I mean, aren't there all kinds of hidden fees that you never know about? And what's a reasonable fee?
You know, the hidden fees are not that hard to find. A place like Morningstar does a pretty good job of capturing all of the fees.
When you say you can look at Morningstar, you just basically look at what fund you are in or that you want to get in, and you just plug that into Morningstar and they'll tell you what the fee is?
Yep, there's a section on there that says fees, or you can get it on MSN Money or Yahoo or any of the sites. Basically, they're all using Morningstar data.
Mm-hmm. What's a reasonable fee?
You know, you shouldn't be paying any more than 1% of your assets.
All right. Well, Jim may be a veritable dictionary of investing lingo, but he's also here today to help answer some of your questions about investing and the markets. So we've got Newcomb on the phone. He's in Ann Arbor, and I think he has the basics figured out already, don't you, Newcomb?
I'm working on it.
you've had an E-Trade account for a few years, right?
About 10, yeah. So the short story is I started this account as a freshman in undergraduate about 10 years ago.
And this was in the height of dot-com craziness. Then.
Right, right. And I was getting my degree in mechanical engineering and Japanese. While I was in college, I was a horrible trader. I would buy stocks if I liked the billboard driving down the street.
Oh, my goodness. Jim, is that what you would call a safe investing strategy?
It is during the last stages of a bull market, yes.
Well, I was 19 and I did okay. And so
yeah.
I had a very Michigan story. I graduated with 2 degrees for the auto industry, and the auto industry wasn't hiring. So I think the best job offer I got was designing windshield washer fluid reservoirs for Pontiac Aztecs.
Wow.
Bottom line is I stopped using my account. I kind of set it and forgot it. And 6 years later, I just started my MBA, and I kind of have the shame of a med student who smokes. As I'm sitting in classes, and I'm learning what I should be doing and what I should have done, and I go and look at my E-Trade account. E-Trade doesn't like when you don't do anything with them for 6 years, and I'm looking at about $1,000 in inactive account fees.
Well, Jim, what do you think? Is this something where he would be better off just getting out and taking the loss of the $1,000, or does he have any leverage here somewhere?
He's got leverage.
Ah.
From the E-Trade end, there's something they would like you not to do, which is that if you're about to resume trading, they don't want you to start trading with ScottTrade or somebody else. They don't want your account to go away at this point. If for nothing else, they need to replace your account, and that costs them money.
Hmm.
What you do is you go in and say to them what is really true, which is that you didn't trade for years and years. Now you're thinking of trading again. You'd love to keep doing business with them, but this fee, you know, sticks in your craw. And if they could find a way to negotiate part of that fee down, you'd stay with them. And if not, you'll pay them their money and you'll leave.
So, Newcomb, what are some of the lessons that you will be applying now that you are going back to trading online?
I want to be less susceptible to the whims of the billboards. I really want to spend some time now that I'm not 19 and I am hitting 30 this year. I want to do what I'm supposed to do and what's appropriate for someone my age.
Newcomb, I want to ask you one final question, which is in this economy with what's going on in the banking industry, why do you feel that an MBA would be worthwhile for you?
Well, I'm actually getting a master's in Japanese as well.
Oh, my goodness.
It may be some time to spend, put my eyes on a different set of scenery for a few years.
All right. Well, boy, a double master's. You're not going to have a life for a while, so I hope it all goes well when you get out.
Well, the insurance is good while you're in school, so at the very least, I've got that covered.
There you go. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. You can also send us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be taking more of your questions later in the show, including a look at what to do with $100 extra a month.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Marketplace Money is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Ever since Cash for Clunkers ended back in August, car dealers have been hoping that maybe the cars themselves might be cool enough to bring you back to the lot. But no fuzzy dice. The government reported this week that auto sales dipped by almost 1% in December, and that's despite all kinds of rebates and incentives designed to get you in the door. Well, we wondered just how good those deals are. So we headed out to a Toyota dealership in Santa Monica to get some answers from our good friend Phil Reed, the consumer advice editor at Edmunds, and I asked him what incentives you're most likely to find right now.
What most people will see is the customer cash rebates. Sometimes they advertise up to $4,000 off on a vehicle. In actuality, in some cases, the low interest and no interest financing actually works out better for people.
And is that still out there?
Oh, yes. Very often they'll be asked to make a choice between customer cash back and low interest financing. And the answer usually lies in calculating the interest rate over a long period of time. Other incentives that people don't hear about or think about very much is lease specials. Leasing has been rebounding slightly.
Why is that?
They want to keep the cars moving, and it's a painless way to get in and out of cars. In the long run, it may cost you more, but in the short run, it's very easy. Little money down and low monthly payments. So sometimes people look at leasing and they say, well, why wouldn't I do that? And the reason is because you can get turned into being a serial leaser.
Yeah.
You always have a payment. And then the final type of incentive that people don't know about is what's called dealer cash.
Really? I feel like I've heard that term in advertising, though.
Dealer cash?
Yeah. Dealer cash back?
They call it all kinds of things. Hidden money, funny money, that kind of thing. But it's substantial. You know, easily $2,000 on a lot of vehicles. The dealer would present you with, you know, I'm going to take a loss on this vehicle. We can go $1,000 under invoice if you buy today. Well, in actuality, if there's $2,000 dealer cash, he's still making $1,000 profit on that transaction.
So is that something that you have to know about and specifically ask for?
Yes. Well, the starting point is knowing about it. And then you can ignore all of the sort of whining that the dealer does about, oh, I'm taking a huge loss on this. You could say, no, actually, I did a little research. There's $2,000 dealer cash. I would like you to share it with me, and I'm looking for the dealer that will share it at the highest ratio.
When do you get into the whole incentive business during the negotiation? I mean, is that, you know, what you've decided on your car and you say, okay, what's the incentive? And then you go deal, or do you get the deal and then say, oh, well, now the incentive is on top of that?
How you apply the incentive is really important, and a lot of people don't do it correctly. Basically, you have to negotiate your best deal and then apply the incentive. So then during the negotiation, you would negotiate your best deal and continue saying, and that would be minus the $1,000 cash back, correct?
Well, this year, it certainly seems like the hybrid and all-electric vehicle is what everybody is talking about, and I think you have one for us to take a test drive in?
Yeah, I have the Ford Fusion Hybrid, which was just this week named Car of the Year.
All right, well, let's check out this car.
Okay, let's go for a ride.
Okay.
Okay, start it up then? Or? Yep. Okay. It started now. This is all electric now. The big thing...
There's no noise.
Well, the beauty of it is we're just waiting for the signal to change, and we're not running the engine. And it has a number of technological features which have been in high-end luxury cars, and now they've been presented in a much more affordable way.
So what's an example of that here?
Well, blind spot detection.
Wait, what is blind spot detection?
Blind spot detection actually...
I don't have that on my car.
Yeah. I wish I had it on mine. It's perfect for Los Angeles and very crowded urban areas. What it does is it essentially shoots a radar beam into your blind spot, and if there's a vehicle there, it will put a warning light on the side mirror. And then we have cross-traffic assist. When you're between two huge SUVs in a parking lot,
yep,
and you can't see what's coming down the row, it will let you know and give you a warning signal here saying there's a car coming from the left or a car coming from the right.
I wonder if folks are going out to look at new cars, are these features something that they should expect? Or are you still, in some cases, having to pay extra for them?
In some cases, they bundle them and present them at a discount. Other cases, they will break them out separately and you pay for them. You have to do a lot of research, so you have to really sit down, look through it carefully, make sure you're getting what you want.
Well, I suppose we should head back to the dealership, because I'm guessing that if talking on the cell phone is bad for you while you're driving, doing an interview is probably even worse.
That's right.
Well, that was a great drive. Thank you very much.
Oh, it was fun. Yeah.
So what do you think are maybe some last-minute thoughts to consider before walking through the doors of a dealership? I know your big thing is you've got to go in with a lot of knowledge, right?
Yeah, well, one of the things I tell people is that if you have the numbers and if you're well-informed, you don't have to worry as much about negotiating. And if it's fact-based negotiation, it depersonalizes things and removes the kind of personal, like, well, I won't pay that, you're crazy, kind of style of negotiating. Instead, you can say things like, well, you know, I'm pretty well acquainted with the market, and you're at least $1,000 over some of the other people that are selling this vehicle. And while it may make them seem sort of annoyed with you, you're actually creating quite a bit of respect, because they'll walk away from you and go back into the back room and say, those people were tough.
All right. Phil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that was Phil Reed from Edmunds.com. For more about dealer incentives, go to our website, marketplace.org. The Great Depression left a big mark on the way people managed their money. But will the Great Recession inspire a new frugality?
There are a lot of people here, middle of the afternoon. They're probably taking out their credit cards, but more people are pulling out a debit card than a credit card.
Maybe, maybe not. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So we've already been to a car lot on the show. How about a trip to the mall? We decided that would be a good place to meet up with our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to talk about his new book called The New Frugality: How to Consume Less, Save More, and Live Better. The scene? Glendale Galleria, a few miles north of Los Angeles. Well, Chris, I'm so glad we could go shopping together.
Absolutely. I've never been to a mall with you. Well, this is a first.
I know, and I've even been to Minnesota to visit you, and we have not gone to the Mall of America.
All right. Your next trip, we will have to go there, at least walk in.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, you say early in your book that our love affair with consumer debt is over.
That's right.
Look around, though, and I wonder if you really think folks here are paying cash for all the stuff that they're buying. There are a lot of people here in the middle of the afternoon.
There are a lot of people here middle of the afternoon. They're probably taking out their credit cards, but more people are pulling out a debit card than a credit card.
Yeah.
In 2008, those lines crossed where debit card usage was greater than credit card usage. So my one guess I have is a lot of people are using a debit card.
Although I did see from creditkarma.com that in the last 6 months of last year, of 2009, credit card usage among people who have cards actually did go up by about 20%.
That's right. But overall, people are paying down their debts and they are saving more. I mean, that's really been the trend throughout the Great Recession, mainly because we have a 10% unemployment rate. If you take our broadest measure of unemployment, it's 17.3%. And so there's a lot of nervousness out there. People have been afraid of whether or not they're going to be able to keep a job. Are they going to get any pay raises? I mean, how many people do you really think are going to be able to march into their boss's office in the next year, 2 years? I'll even go out so far.
Say, give me more money.
And say, give me a 10% raise.
Right.
Or I'm leaving. And they're going to say goodbye.
Now, we've discussed this before, and I think we've agreed to disagree about what this Great Recession is really going to mean in the long term. I just don't believe that it's going to have long-term effect on people's spending and saving decisions. But give me your argument for perhaps believing in our society more than I do.
All right.
What is the new frugality?
Well, a couple things. First of all, we're still going to be borrowing. We're still going to be spending. We still are a consumer society. But the pendulum swung way too far in terms of borrowing relative to what we are earning.
Right.
And so we're going to go back into a better balance. And there's a couple of forces that are going to drive us toward a better balance. First of all, it's going to take a long time for the banks to repair their balance sheets. So they're not going to lend to you the way that they did in the past or to the consumer. And regulators, they have been embarrassed. On their watch, all this bad stuff happened. So they are going to enforce a certain conservatism. Now, the other side, the consumer. What are people learning? They realize that we don't have enough of our own savings, enough of our own safety net. And that's the lesson. And that's the conversation that's going around about being smart about savings as opposed to bragging about how much you can borrow.
I want to take you to another element of your book, which is you really use a good chunk of it as a bully pulpit for sustainability.
Yes.
And you say that leading a sustainable lifestyle can actually help our pocketbooks as
That's
well.
Right. Yep. And this is what I think makes it the new frugality.
Yeah.
I remember my father would always, every night, unplug the appliances and all the lamps. And I always thought that was ridiculous, right? Why would he do that? He did that because that saved money. But now people are doing it because they think it's better for the environment. Lots of people learn that being green and being frugal can reinforce each other. It's a really optimistic act because you know what? You believe you're making a difference. And I do believe that you are. And that's why it's the new frugality. We're doing it consciously. We're doing it to make the world a better place. And that's going to reinforce the savings.
And finally, at the end of the book, one thing you talk about is finding the right balance between saving and spending. And this notion of smoothing out those habits over a lifetime. So many of us are obsessed with saving for retirement. And you argue actually at the end of the book that A, spending is not bad, and B, you really need to think about not saving all of your eggs for the end of your life.
Yeah, you don't want to go from one extreme to the other. And there's a big difference between being frugal and being cheap. So if all you do is save, you are fundamentally a cheap human being. At the same time, you don't want to be 40 years old and have borrowed to the hilt with an economy like we have today, worried about losing your job. So it's trying to achieve this balance, and the new frugality or embracing frugality is the way to go.
Well, I certainly hope that you are right. Thanks so much, Chris. And, you know, we're standing outside Abercrombie & Fitch.
Yeah.
If you'd like, you're more than welcome to go in and try on some baggy pants.
Well, that'd be a look for me. How about a cup of coffee?
Oh, I think that works for both of us.
Much better.
Let's go.
Go ahead. Keep that image, folks. Chris Farrell in saggy pants. His new book is The New Frugality, How to Consume Less, Save More, and Live Better. And you can buy it through our website, marketplace.org.
My bank account has never seen disposable income. I use everything I make and then some.
Commentator and youth radio reporter Summer Sewell.
I'm a college graduate and I work. Still, I pay for meals with loose change. I calculate the price per ounce in the cereal aisle to ensure the best deal. Apparently, this makes me part of a new trend you've probably read about, being frugal. But there's nothing new about it to me. I've been living in my own personal recession since before the real one started. My financial life is, well, first I pay rent and then my bills for the month. Health insurance is a luxury. I haven't had insurance for almost 2 years. DayQuil is my doctor. I can't afford to think about a more serious illness or a medical emergency or even paying for antibiotics out of pocket. The occasional parking ticket alone can almost swallow my so-called savings. Being broke means it's never both. It's either or, as in friends or food. Do I go out with friends or use the money to buy groceries? Do I buy my mom a birthday present or get my oil changed? Do I buy a new comforter or fix a leaky tire? Life is a revolving catch-22. If I use my credit card to pay a bill, I'm stuck with finance charges. I can only ever pay the minimum balance. I notice finance charges down to the penny because I study my online banking account like I was writing a thesis on it. I check it regularly to see that my paychecks have cleared before I put a stamp on my rent check or fill up my tank. I've never had the money to keep up with trends. I've never tried to be hip. I have no clue where the newest swank eatery in LA is, but I know how to buy Chinatown vegetables and add them to Top Ramen for a $1 dinner. And for 2010, that makes me part of a trend that's been my life for years, being frugal.
Summer Sewell lives in Los Angeles. Her commentary was produced for us by Youth Radio. All right, it's time to take some more of your calls, and investing columnist Jim Jubak joins us again. And Jim, you walked us through some investing basics earlier, and Chris in San Francisco wrote in about yet another financial must-know, and this is the Target Date Fund. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Jim, before we get to Chris's question, why don't you give us a simple definition of a Target Date Fund?
It's like a mutual fund, but with the idea that the strategy of the fund will change as it approaches the target date. And the idea in this is that they become more and more conservative as the time goes by, so that by the time the target date approaches, they may be 100% invested in bonds or something like that.
All right. Well, Chris, do you have a target date fund?
I do, actually. And I guess that's my question, is that we moved all of our money into 2040 target retirement funds. And I know that, you know, the people who manage those funds are diversifying what the assets are invested in and things, but it still seems to me like I have all of our eggs in one basket.
Well, so what do you think about target date retirement funds? Is this a good way for folks to invest and not necessarily have to worry about it year by year?
I think if you work through all of the potential pitfalls, they can be really, really useful. The first pitfall is, okay, all of us are hopefully living longer. Retirement is getting pushed off. So one of the big problems is that how long does your money have to last? And the problem with a target fund is that, you know, by the end of the target, you're all in bonds, which means that you're being very, very conservative. And my worry there would be, am I being too conservative too early?
And then maybe we're also getting at the question here of whether to have all of your various retirement funds, all of your 401ks, all of your Roth IRAs in these target date funds. And at least, you know, maybe you spread that out so a couple of them are 2040 and a couple of them are 2050, something like that.
You're getting at the real problem in all retirement planning, which is that, you know, there are things we simply don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you going to still be working? Are you going to be able to work? All these things you don't know. And so saying that, you know, I'm going to become 100% in bonds in 2040 because of this target fund, I think opens you up to a lot of uncertainty risk, if you will.
Chris, I know you and your wife are both CPAs. You are aware of how this financial sausage is made. I wonder if that adds to your anxiety.
I think being CPAs, you know, makes us know what we don't know, essentially.
Right.
With the target funds, I think we need to do our homework and see to what extent their strategy matches up with ours.
So it sounds like that's your first step, Chris.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
All right. Well, good luck.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. Good question.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And next up, we have Rachel. She's in Washington, D.C., and she and her husband have, good for them, about $100 extra dollars to toy with every month. How did that happen, Rachel?
Well, basically, he was able to go on his health insurance plan from his employer, where he had been on mine. So we're seeing a little extra money in our pocket.
Well, that's always a nice thing.
Yeah.
And nothing obvious that you'd want to put this toward?
Well, there are several things. Just so you know, we would both love to quit our day jobs eventually and live the bohemian life, so, because we're both classical singers in addition to our day jobs.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah. So we probably shouldn't assume that we'll be working these jobs till retirement.
Okay.
Our only debts are student loans and our mortgage. So there's several options here.
Well, why not just have an extra dinner party or two? That's what I'm saying.
Exactly. Or throw better dinner parties than we already
do. Are you angling for an invitation?
Yes.
Anytime.
Well, boy, it sounds to me like they've actually started off really well. So, Jim, where do you think this extra $100 should go?
The only thing you've left out is that tiny little apartment overlooking the Grand Canal in Venice, because
exactly.
I mean, where else would you want to sing? You know, one of the big mistakes that people make when they think about how they've got their assets divided is they never think about their real estate as being part of the whole pot.
Right.
And so, you know, you look at this and go, okay, so I've got X amount in the stock market, I've got X amount in real estate. How does this all figure out? Sounds like you've probably got enough in cash, so you don't need to worry about that. But, you know, do that allocation and make sure that you're not so heavily overweighted toward real estate, which most Americans really are. I mean, the houses that we live in are the major financial asset for most families.
Well, and the down payment check was the biggest check either one of us had ever written in our lives.
I think that's the case for most of us as homeowners.
Right.
It's quite shocking. Rachel, what about, have you ever thought of maybe having a dream fund where that dream is that you do quit your jobs and become full-time musicians?
Well, I've actually been thinking a lot about that lately and just trying to save more, but the problem is the saving rates are so abysmal right now.
You know, I mean, with $100 a month, I would try to find a low fee, you know, relatively diversified index or ETF with some global exposure, because I think that's your best shot at getting $100 a month to grow into something that would let you do what you really want to do.
Well, thank you very much. I never thought about doing anything like that. I just thought about, you know, applying it toward the debts that we already have.
Rachel, thanks so much for the call. Good
thanks
luck.
Thanks for your advice.
Your personal finance questions are always music to our ears, so do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. Jim Jubak of JubakPicks.com, thanks so much. It's been great having you on the show.
It's been a lot of fun, Tess.
And next week, we'll be talking about saving for school and spending abroad. Do tune in. And remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Now, every so often we get a question from one of you where I think to myself, I wish I could ask Ann Landers about this, or maybe Dear Prudence at Slate.com. It's usually a question that's about money, but not really about money. And we got one like that this week. Ursula contacted us from Surrey, Maine, with a dilemma.
My fiancé and I would like to request that our friends not give gifts we do not need for our wedding, like dishes and china. If they decide in their generosity to give a gift, we want to ask that they contribute to a fund for something we want, like land or gift certificates. Is there an artful way to make this clear to our guests?
Now, this is a question that I know Dear Prudence has answered more than once, so we called her up. Emily Yaffe, a.k.a. Prudence, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I'm not going to pretend I don't know your thoughts on this. You are not a fan of the gimme cold hard cash wedding registry, right?
When people are getting married, their friends and loved ones want to get lovely things for their home. They don't tend to want to get them a home.
Is it ever okay to put qualifiers on gift giving, really no matter what the occasion might be?
Well, there are ways to do it. First of all, let me just say, when you send the invitation, that is not the place to specify the gift. The money question is really touchy and hard. It's probably best if the word gets put out by other people in the family. Look, they're paying off their student loans or they're saving for a house. So if you feel moved to write them a check, of course they'd appreciate it. But you just can't say, hey, don't go shopping for me. Here's my PIN number. Make a deposit.
That's so romantic, isn't it? Yeah, you know, and you mentioned the invitations, and I will say that I did receive a wedding invitation one time that listed the gift registry. It didn't ask for cash, but it did actually list the gift registry, and you're saying, to that as well.
Well, how did you feel when you got that?
I thought, oh, well, I guess that's the price I pay for going to the wedding.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. You felt, price of admission.
Yep.
That's not the feeling you're supposed to get when you get a wedding invitation.
But I suppose the argument is that, you know, we live in modern times. A lot of couples already live together. They've got things like blenders and towels. So what should a guest do in that case?
How is it ever wrong to go out and say, you know, I'm so happy they're getting married. I want to get them this beautiful pitcher so every time they pour their juice or milk with it, they'll think of me and I'll imagine them enjoying it. I mean, you know, that is part of the pleasure. It's not just an economic exchange.
All right. Well, Ursula, there you go. Dear Prudence says maybe you should be a little more prudent about all this, right?
Enjoy everyone's good wishes, even if it takes a physical form of a blender.
Emily Yaffe is dearprudence@slate.com. It's been awfully fun. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Okay, what's your reaction to requests for gifts of cold, hard cashola? Tell us at marketplace.org. And no, you do not have a year to write us a thank you note. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, would you pay $29 to see a movie?
I moved from no way to I would for a special occasion. No kids, good food, although I couldn't always see what I was eating.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org. Or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering strategies for investors seeking both returns and lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.